morning. This morning we have with us Lincoln High School from Wisconsin Rapids. Would these students please rise so we can see them? Thank you very much. Would you be seated? The Lincoln High School students are here with the Court with Class program that is run by the State Bar in this court. And they have had summaries provided them about this case, and there are summaries available on the table outside. Now that we have met you, we'd like you to meet us. And I will start on my far right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babbage, and in the empty chair, ordinarily would be seated Justice Jeanine Geske, but Justice Geske is at home recuperating, and the reason we're late is that we are... That was the dog. The reason we are late, and I apologize for the court being late, the reason we're late is that for the first time in the history of the court with high technology, which is means a long extension cord, Justice Geske is with us on the telephone. We don't know how this will work, but we shall see. Justice Geske, can you say hello?
Hello. I'm glad I can participate.
Okay, now, we can hear you on the bench. I think it's hard outside, but if you wish to ask a question, we can relay it to counsel. So,
keep control of your dogs.
I promise.
Keep control of the dogs. And finally, Justice Pat Crooks.
In person.
With those introductions and with an explanation for our tardiness, I will call the first case, which is 97-1320, Danan and Jansen versus Cedar Rapids. And Mr. George Burnett will represent the plaintiff appellant.
May it please the court. My name is George Burnett, and I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Danan and Jansen, Incorporated, in this case, which was certified to this court for decision by the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. This case presents an important issue of commercial law in the state of Wisconsin. Specifically, the issue presented is whether the economic loss doctrine that this court first announced in the Sunny Slope grading case in the mid-1980s should be extended to apply to a situation where the parties have no direct contract, lack privity of contract between them. I will be very brief regarding the factual circumstance underlying this case because this is purely an issue of law. The district court, Judge Reynolds, decided to grant summary judgment against the plaintiff in this case. By way of explanation, the product involved here is called a pitman. A pitman is a large metal slab used in the quarry industry. It's a component part of a rock crushing machine. This particular pitman, bought by Danan and Jansen, was purchased from a distributor by the name of Earing Equipment Company, located in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Earing Equipment contracted with Cedar Rapids to manufacture this pitman. The important part of the pitman was that it had to be square, and it had to be flat, and it had to be manufactured very precisely. The purchase occurred in approximately 1991. Shortly after the purchase ensued, Danan and Jansen began to experience breakdowns in their equipment. It took the better part of 2 years to discover what the cause of those breakdowns were, the breakdowns in their rock crushing machinery. Ultimately, at Nichols Machine Company, it was determined that the pitman was placing abnormal, unintended stresses on the rock crushing equipment because it was not manufactured flat and it was not manufactured square. Those are the facts that I think this court should assume for purposes of this hearing. The liability in this case is contested, but because this was a decision on summary judgment, I think those facts should be assumed under our summary judgment procedure. The the important point is that Dana Najansen received no direct warranty or engaged in any contract of any type with Cedar Rapids.
Now, they could have, had they wanted, if I understand the facts, they could have received a warranty. They could have asked for one, and they would have gotten it from the retailer airing who they bought the Pitland from, right? As I understand the facts, Cedar Rapids gave a warranty to their supplier or the seller, and if in the ordinary course of commercial activity your client had asked for one, they would have been given one. At least that's the fact, as I understood.
That is the Cedar Rapids' principal position,
yes,
I think, in this case, Your Honor.
I want to know your response.
My response is that is correct in with a one qualification. Earing Equipment Company failed to pass this warranty on. So a key question in this case is whose responsibility is it to answer for Earing Equipment's value? It was intended, I concede, by Cedar Rapids that their product be warranted, and at the same time that an exclusion or a limitation of limited warranty be issued, and an exclusion of consequential damages be provided. But that was not passed on, and it's simply our position that the failure to pass that on is a responsibility that Cedar Rapids must ultimately assume, because Earing Equipment was their agent. And it's well-established Wisconsin law that a principal is responsible for the acts or omissions of his agent.
What responsibility does the agent have to pass this on? I mean, why? I go and buy a RCA boombox, and it costs $150, and then they say, oh, and if you want to spend another $14 per year, you can get the warranty. I mean, in today's marketplace, oftentimes the warranty costs, the same with a washing machine, the same with all sorts of appliances. So why can't the argument be made that Aaron has no responsibility to pass this on? If they do, and they want to negotiate it as part of the price and have Dannon pay whatever the equivalent of $14 per year for Pitman is, you can negotiate it. There's no responsibility to negotiate it. Would you respond to that, please?
Sure. I think the responsibility, and I think both parties will agree to this, is imposed in the distributorship agreement between Cedar Rapids and Earing. If it's not in the distributorship agreement, it certainly was expected by the parties' course of conduct. I think all agree that in this particular situation, like in any other sale, this was a situation where Cedar Rapids expected a limited warranty to be passed on. More importantly, this is, in my view, not the way most commercial transactions run. It is very rare for a company like Dana and Janssen, who is dealing directly with a distributor, to insist on speaking directly with the manufacturer. While that is an opportunity that you to buy a limited warranty or buy a special warranty that you see in a discount chain like Best Buy or something like that, that's not the general course of dealings that businessmen, especially unsophisticated businessmen, engage in. Does that answer your question?
Dannon, you're not saying Dannon was unsophisticated.
I am saying that Dannon operates about 8 quarries in Brown County. It's a large business operation for Brown County, Wisconsin. But it's a family-owned business, and it's been a family-owned business for generations. Cedar Rapids is in a position where it can employ lawyers and that type of thing to craft its warranties and to limit its remedies, but that's not the way most businessmen in Dana and Janssen's position operate.
I'm having a little trouble. This case is a certified question by the Federal Court of Appeals. All of this about warranties and liability for agency. Is any of that before us? I mean, it strikes me the only facts we know are your client bought what it alleges is a defective product, and we have to assume it is. And they bought it from, they're now suing, not their seller, their immediate seller. They're suing Cedar Rapids, who I assume is the manufacturer. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And they have no warranty from Cedar Rapids, the manufacturer, so they don't stand in privity of contract, right?
That's correct.
And they're suing for lost profits because this machine was defective.
That's correct.
So we're not worried about the value of the machine. We're not worried about personal injury caused by a defective product. We're not worried about any of that. We're worried about a suit against a manufacturer from whom the product was not bought.
That's right.
And the question before the court is, as I see it, a very limited one. Under those circumstances, which we have to accept, can you get loss of profits because you bought a machine, it didn't perform the way you expected it to do, therefore you lost profits, called economic loss?
I agree,
right?
With the way you characterize it.
That's the only thing before the court. Everything else, as I understand it, I mean, this is the record in this case.
Yes.
Right? Everything else in this case is not before us. We don't know anything about it.
Actually, the record on summary judgment was rather voluminous.
Do we have anything here other than the joint statement of facts?
To the Seventh Circuit?
Yeah.
No, I think...
Do we have the summary judgment material from the Seventh Circuit?
I don't know if the Seventh Circuit forwarded that.
Well, I don't think so.
If I could respond to your question,
okay.
The reason that the issue of what was intended by Cedar Rapids and whether Ehring Equipment performed their responsibilities is important is only if one accepts the argument that Danan and Jansen should have done something more, that they should have gone directly to the manufacturer and sought a remedy that Wisconsin law, according to the respondent, would not otherwise provide. I think the bedrock issue in this case is the concept of tort duty in Wisconsin. Now, this court has spoken to that issue many, many times.
Mr. Burnett, before you get into that, let me follow up on the Chief's question. And let me ask you about your pleadings in this case to begin with. Do your pleadings in any way assert an implied warranty right to recover against Cedar Rapids?
They did originally. Procedurally, this case was filed in Brown County Circuit Court, removed by Cedar Rapids to the Eastern District of Wisconsin. The pleadings were originally framed in both express warranty, implied warranty, strict liability, and negligence. At the summary judgment stage, Cedar Rapids urged upon the district court that because privity was lacking, there is no basis for an implied warranty or an express warranty claim. And based on this court's decision in Northbrook, it was correct.
The reason I'm asking that is it's my understanding that a number of jurisdictions that have used the economic loss doctrine as a bar to recovery in cases like this have then allowed a recovery on an implied warranty theory. Is that correct?
That is correct. Those cases are cited in the reply brief here, and that is either imposed as a matter of by the legislature, or in several cases, as I recall, is done by the court as a matter of common law.
And that's even with a lack of privity?
That's even with a lack of privity.
What's the difference? What difference does it make if you're able to proceed on one theory or the other?
The theory, ultimately, the suitability of the product for its intended use, I think, as a factual matter, if and when this case is ever presented with the jury, will be very similar, regardless under either theory. I think this court's decision in Dipple versus Ciano prevents the presentation of a warranty claim, at least at this point in the under the state of the law. I think the court decided that very clearly in Dipple, that it was not inclined to supersede the privity doctrine.
Well, implied warranty here would have to be from Cedar, what's it called, Cedar Rapids to Dana.
Yes.
Even though there was no privity. It's adding privity then.
That's right.
It's not between Aaron and Dana that you would ask for an implied warranty.
That
would be a different case.
That would be a different case.
But this is the defendant in Cedar Rapids. So what by implying a warranty, you're just saying by law, Cedar Rapids is required to warrant its product for the use for which Cedar Rapids manufactured it.
Precisely what the legislature did in Chapter 402 of the Wisconsin statutes, when where there is privity, they have implied a warranty of merchantability unless it's disclaimed.
But you're not relying on the commercial code because you don't have a buyer and a seller here.
I can't rely on the commercial code based on the language of the code in this court's decision in Dipple.
So then just following up on that, it seems to me that if we were to extend either the implied warranty or we go along and say that in this case, even though it is a tort, there would be some recovery. What would be the what's the cutoff? Is it we're talking? You had this machine for 3 years. What if you had it for 15 years, 27 years? I mean, is there any? Doesn't this open people or manufacturers up to sort of some unanticipated liability?
There's two answers to that question. The first answer is found in this court's decision in Sunnyslope. In Sunnyslope, this court held in a situation where there were backhoes, heavy construction equipment purchased, but the manufacturer passed on a warranty. This court held that you could not end run that warranty, and this court was unwilling to impose remedies that the parties had disclaimed in their contract. A manufacturer can limit its liability simply by passing on a warranty or excluding consequential damages. This is a case where a manufacturer failed to do that, and that's why I say that the bedrock of this case falls on the notion of duty under tort law. There are a series of Wisconsin cases from this court that I think impose that duty on Cedar Rapids as a matter of law. And this court has, the last time it spoke to this issue was in the Rock White decision, which involved a three-year-old child being burned in a campfire. The last time this court spoke to this issue, it indicated that the question of duty remains the same as it has for a long time since the Pfeiffer versus Standard Theater decision.
But the duty here, I mean, just factually, this Pittman didn't work. You tried to repair it. Eventually, as I understand it, Cedar Rapids came out, tried to repair it, in fact, offered a new or a different Pittman, said that we'll replace it. Well, isn't that the extent of their obligation to try to do something and to replace it instead of waiting around for either 10 or 12 years and then or 3 years, then having somebody say, well, it didn't work, therefore our economic loss is $400,000 or whatever?
The law in the state of Wisconsin is that consequential damages like these are expected in commercial transactions under the code unless they're excluded. The law is that one has a responsibility to refrain from any act which will cause foreseeable harm to others, even though the nature of that act and the identity of the harmed person or interest is unknown at the time of the act. That's the law of duty in the state of Wisconsin. Now, this argument that duty should be abrogated because the parties have lacked privity has been faced by this court no less than five times. The argument was faced in the AE Link case, where an architect argued that he was not responsible for a sinking floor in a grocery store because he didn't have a contract with the tenant who was operating the grocery store. It was faced in Orrick versus Continental Casualty, where a lawyer argued that he wasn't responsible to the beneficiary of a will because there was no privity. He was not his client. It was faced in Tim versus Citizens State Bank, where an accountant argued that he was not responsible to a bank that relied on his audit report submitted to the bank's customer. And in the products arena. It was faced in Smith versus Atco, which is this court's first venture into the area of products liability under 402A, where a manufacturer of feed for minks argued that he was not responsible for poisoning the animals because he lacked privity. And finally, and most importantly, it was faced in the City of La Crosse case, where the City of La Crosse entered into a contract to get a new roof with a general contractor, who entered into a contract with a roofing subcontractor, who entered into a contract with the Kaiser Aluminum Company, who furnished a faulty aluminum roof. This court held in City of La Crosse that the City of La Crosse had a direct claim under 402A against the Kaiser Aluminum Company for purely economic losses.
Counsel?
Yes.
Are you finished? Please.
Now, Your Honor, we hear this same argument again, now from the manufacturer of heavy industrial equipment, who says, I have no such duty because I am not in privity of contract with these people.
You've twice said, if not maybe three times thus far, that the bedrock of this case falls on the notion of duty and tort law. And I look at some of our cases, I look at the Northridge case, and it discusses the difference between the policy behind tort and the policy behind contract. The policy behind tort, it says, torts protect safety, contracts protect the bargain. What tort duty is involved in this case?
The duty to exercise due care so that you do not harm another if that harm is foreseeable.
But here we're talking about damage to the product, not personal injury or property damage, right?
That's correct.
So it has nothing to do with safety. I mean, when I say the tort, and Northridge describes tort protects safety to property, can't damage property, safety to person, you can't engage in personal injury. What, and the tort duty here is what, vis-a-vis safety?
What
safety component is there here?
This is what many of the courts say. The distinction that the courts make is that a contract case involves failed economic expectations, and a tort case involves issues of safety for the general public.
That's an overstate generalization, isn't it?
Yes, it appears.
Because if I'm injured, you're going to give me lost wages, which is profits.
That's
nothing
right.
to do with safety.
That's right. You can injure a man just as easily by devastating his business as you can from hurting him physically. I don't think that the world is that there are bright line rules between that type of situation. I think that
what you're talking about is the remedy, not the cause of action. I mean, the tort cause of action is based on safety.
The economic loss doctrine ultimately is addressed at the remedy, because what it says is that a particular type of damage, economic losses, consequential damages, the cost of repairing the property may not be recovered.
Is there a tort of negligent interference with business? I mean, there's an intentional interference with business, but isn't that what your tort is here? That, I mean, as I hear you, you're not in strict liability anymore. You're asking, if I hear you, you're saying that this is a negligence action for negligent manufacture of a product, and that the foreseeable consequence is damage to a business that uses that. Isn't that your cause of action?
And I addressed that point, Your Honor, in the last page of the reply brief, where I indicated to the court that I really thought that there were two separate questions here, and the question number one is whether a cause of action would be recognized in negligence, and question number two would be whether or not a cause of action would be recognized in strict liability. Those are not questions that are mutually exclusive. This court could certainly recognize a cause of action in negligence, but not in strict liability for all the policy reasons alluded to here.
One of your arguments, counsel, is that you have no remedy and you don't want to be remedy-less. Don't you have a remedy against the distributor?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. We have a potential remedy against the distributor, and the question is, in Wisconsin, does this court intend to tell a manufacturer of a product that is defective that it has no responsibility whatsoever against the ultimate buyer of that product unless it expressly assumes that in an agreement? That's the question. I think that that message that would be given to manufacturers who do business in this state is simply the wrong one. I think the genius of Sunny Slope is that it allows a manufacturer of a product to reduce that exposure, to limit that responsibility simply by contract, by passing along a warranty, something that is done day in and day out in the commercial setting in this state.
Now, in Sunny Slope, you didn't have a privity issue because you had a limited manufacturer's warranty that apparently the dealer could pass off to the next guy, to the purchaser. So there was an agreement in effect between the manufacturer and the ultimate buyer.
The
court said that agreement is okay.
That's right. And you cannot expand that agreement into the tort arena either. And that was my point, or albeit inarticulately, in answer to your question. My time is short, so what I want to do is just provide this court one indication as to why I think that this court should decline to follow the Seventh Circuit precedent that is voluminous on this issue. There are two lines of Seventh Circuit cases here. There's the Miller line of cases that are premised, as I read them, on a misreading of Wisconsin law.
You can finish your sentence.
Miller said that this court reserved the question of privity in Sunny Slope. And it, you can find that quotation at page 973 of Miller. I think when you look at the Miller's statement on that and you compare the page that they're citing in Sunny Slope, they're citing the discussion of lacrosse in Sunny Slope where the court made no such reservation at all. In fact, the court limited lacrosse to a situation where there was no privity. So the ultimate point is that if the court is to accept the notion that the economic loss doctrine applies, it must overrule the lacrosse case.
Thank you very much, Counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Raggetts, you represent Cedar Rapids Incorporated.
May it please the court. My name is Ron Raggetts. I'm with the Madison Law Firm of DeWitt Ross and Stevens, and I represent the appellee in this litigation, Cedar Rapids. Economic losses are risks. The basis of the economic loss doctrine is that the economic losses between commercial parties are the kind of risks that can effectively be dealt with by the commercial parties and that should effectively be dealt with by the commercial parties. That we should have a situation where commercial parties are free to allocate those risks among themselves. Applying the economic loss doctrine in situations where there's a lack of privity promotes that goal. Creating an exception to the economic loss doctrine where there is no privity undermines that goal. In this case, using Danen and Jansen as an example, and I agree that what we have before us is a pure question of law, but the facts of this case, I think, can in some cases serve to be an example. What Danen and Jansen asks for is a tort remedy that will put it in a better position than if it had bargained for a warranty in the first place. It asks for a tort remedy that will probably put it in a better position than if it were dealing, if it had dealt directly with the manufacturer and were proceeding under the Uniform Commercial Code.
Suppose it had dealt with the manufacturer and there was nothing stated about warranty, nothing about loss. just a straight purchase and sale.
Right.
What would, and now the product's defective and there's a loss of profit. What's the remedy?
The remedy, first of all, let me address how I believe that that would play differently than the tort situation. And that is that in this case, as was discussed before, we have a situation where the problems with the product allegedly went on for approximately 3 years before any claim was made, before Cedar Rapids received any notice of any problem. And that was a situation where, if you look into the damage records, we have alleged problems on 51 different days in 10 different months over a three-year period. They attempted to deal with the problem themselves. They did not notify Cedar Rapids. If Cedar Rapids is in the position of the direct seller, the Uniform Commercial Code provides that notice shall be provided of any breach to the seller as soon as reasonably possible after discovery of the defect or after the defect should reasonably have been known. And I believe that in a case where you have, and I should add that the purpose of that kind of provision in the Uniform Commercial Code, I believe it's 402.607 sub 3.
Let's ignore that for the moment. Let's just get to the remedy. Let's not deal with the facts here. Suppose that they gave you immediate notice, and there's nothing said about a warranty in the immediate sale between Cedar Rapids and Damon. What do you do?
Damon and Jansen would have a claim for breach of implied warranty, probably of merchantability, probably not of of fitness for a particular purpose, depending on the circumstances.
Okay, and they would recover lost profits if they could prove that it was a defective product.
If the products, the lost profits were reasonably foreseeable.
All right, so that is what would happen if there was privity, right?
Yes.
Okay. So your complaint is there's no privity here, therefore you shouldn't apply this contract course of action.
To Cedar Rapids.
Yes.
Correct.
All right.
And to follow up on that, we do have the situation with Aerien Equipment Company, which is the direct seller. And I believe
they're not in the lawsuit at the moment.
They're not in the lawsuit.
Okay.
But to the extent that one of the things we're worried about, or one of the policy considerations here, is will the buyer be left without a remedy unless there's a tort claim against the manufacturer? The answer to that, in a typical circumstance, is no. They will have an implied warranty claim against the direct seller. That implied warranty claim is only going to disappear if they struck a different bargain with the seller. And in this case, there is some indication of that, but again, we don't know enough to know that. That's going to have to be sorted out in the separate suit between Aerien and...
It would also disappear if the immediate seller disappeared. The chances are the manufacturer will be there longer than a particular seller.
It may be the odds-on chance, although I don't believe that there's any, in this case, reason to believe that that's a problem.
I mean, that's one reason for suing the manufacturer.
That would be...
In a deeper pocket, ordinarily.
Yes.
Okay.
Let me pursue what I think is the benefit to a rule that does not allow the tort claim directly against the manufacturer. And let me use an example different than this case, because this is really a question, pure question of law. Let's assume that a company, the Pleasant Company or someone like that, is in need of computer equipment. They can go to a vendor such as a Best Buy or a Circuit City or a small one like Computer Plus, and they have a range of options. One option is buy the top quality, top of the line, and get your full manufacturer's two-year warranty, and it's going to cost you more money. Maybe that's $2,500 a piece. Second option is, well, you can go perhaps with a comparable model with no manufacturer's warranty, but we'll sell you our in-house service plan, and that will cover you for 2 years. That costs a little less than the full manufacturer's warranty, but more than a third option. The third option is buy a model that gives you no warranty, and don't buy the direct seller's service plan. Instead, agree to a disclaimer of implied warranties with the direct seller, and under those circumstances, you get the lowest price. Now, that's a kind of decision that should be made by the buyer. Buyer's in the position to know what kind of risks it's in a position to accept for a lower cost.
Well, and the fourth example would be you buy and nothing is said about warranty at all.
Correct. In which case, they would have an implied warranty against the direct seller.
Well, that's this case, and what they want is to get at you.
Correct. And my point is, that decision should be made by the buyer. Why should it be made by the buyer? Well, the buyer may have its own in-house service department. It may decide, why should I spend $200, $300, $400 more buying warranty protection when I have my own people that can handle this? The buyer may be in a position to accept more risk. It may have redundancy in its equipment. It may have the ability to have some downtime on some equipment with no loss of sales, no loss of profits. You want the buyer to be able to make those give-and-take decisions based upon the price of the product. And it really is something that is the type of the thing that is negotiated with respect to products every day.
Well, you know, I'd buy, and I probably wouldn't buy the warranty, figure I'll take my chances. And all machines break sooner or later, but that's one thing. But then if I buy a machine and it is just by design not capable of functioning, then I don't think that I've made a decision on warranty. I've made a decision that I take my chances on ordinary breakdowns, not on a totally defective product. So why shouldn't I, if the product is really totally defective for its purpose, still not have the opportunity to sue the manufacturer?
Let me answer it two ways. And let me start with the context of this case, which is what I have in mind, and I think it's helpful to have a concrete case. When you say, was it totally defective, I don't think the record supports that it was totally defective.
That may be true. Take my example, though.
If you have a case where it's totally defective as a product, and you've made a knowing decision that I will accept that risk.
I made a decision to buy your product, thinking that could be a lemon, this particular one, and it could be great. But that I didn't expect it to be totally unfit for the purpose for which I bought it.
Again, we have to look at the context in which this question is framed. And this question, one of the limitations on this question inherently is we're talking about commercial parties. I think in today's world, a commercial party, even a Dana and a Janssen is an example. They spend millions of dollars each year on the business. I think in today's world, there has to be a reasonable expectation that there will be some thought as to quality, reliability, and what happens if it isn't.
So if I were just a farmer down the road and bought this machine, then you'd have a different rule, maybe?
A farmer's a difficult example because the question becomes whether a farmer is really, truly a commercial entity or is more of a consumer. But I think that the question before the court is confined to commercial parties, commercial buyer, commercial seller.
Your examples, Mr. Raggetts, all seem to be premised on sort of an equality of bargaining position. I can think of a lot of instances in which there, I don't think, would be equal bargaining power. Let's assume a mom and pop, videotaping business. They purchase a Sony video recorder to do their business. They purchase it from Circuit City. Or they purchase it, Circuit City's not going to go out of business. They purchase it from another small dealer, and it doesn't do what it's supposed to do, and they lose thousands of dollars worth of business because of it. And meanwhile, the store that they bought it from has gone out of business. Now, you're saying here, I take it, that they should not be able to sue Sony for the thousands of dollars that they lost due to the defective equipment.
Yes, I am.
And why is that?
And the reason is...
What's fair about that?
What is fair about that is, I mean, first of all, there's inherently a problem when you talk about a mom and pop and a direct seller that goes out of business.
Sure.
I
understand that's as loaded as your examples, which is, but I'm not sure which one prevails in the marketplace. I suspect there's more mom and pops than there are very sophisticated business people out there, but I could be wrong.
I think that, and of course, that's one of the reasons that I try to bring it back to the example in this case, but let me address your circumstance. I think that that is an unfortunate circumstance primarily because the buyer purchased from someone who went out of business and was not substantial, and that under those circumstances, that's a difficult, you know, tragic perhaps, set of circumstances. I don't think that we should decide Wisconsin policy of commercial law with respect to that kind of scenario, but that rather we have to look to what we would anticipate to be a more typical situation with...
Okay, then let's put it into your situation. I'm a mom and pop and I purchased from Circuit City. Why shouldn't I be able to sue Sony as well as Circuit City?
Part of the question is why would you need to sue Sony in addition to Circuit City? But the reason
I'm mad at Sony. they've given me a bad product.
The reason is we have a well thought out body of law with respect to commercial transactions, and that's the Uniform Commercial Code. That's the vehicle that should be used to resolve these disputes. It's a vehicle that was really designed around economic disputes such as this, rather than personal injury or damage to other property cases. And that in that chain, it will happen, depending upon the relationship between the manufacturer and Circuit City, the same result will come about if the manufacturer and Circuit City have not arrived at any allocation of the liability between themselves. That in effect what would happen is the buyer would sue Circuit City would implead the manufacturer, Sony, and the end result would be the same. Where it differs is where Sony has negotiated with Circuit City for a different arrangement. They have allocated the risk of loss differently between themselves, and in that position, if you then allow the seller to circumvent Circuit City and sue Sony directly, you have allowed a circumvention of the contractual allocation of risk between Circuit City and Sony.
Mr. Raggetts, let me interrupt and ask you something else. This is a case where the Seventh Circuit has said to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, tell us what the law is in regard to the economic loss doctrine and whether it's a bar where there's no privity. Have we not already answered that question in the City of La Crosse case? And if not, how do you distinguish that case?
Let me answer that in a couple of different ways. First of all, in the City of La Crosse, and I believe one of the contentions of Dana and Jansen is that this court would have to overrule the holding of the City of La Crosse. It is my position, it's Cedar Rapids' position, that was, to the extent that the City of La Crosse had language about an indirect buyer, a remote buyer, being able to sue a manufacturer for purely economic losses, it was dicta. Because in the case itself, there was a statement that there were, in fact, damages to other property in that case, and under Wisconsin law, that is really the touchstone for whether the economic loss doctrine would apply. Secondly, in Sunny Slope, there was a discussion about the La Crosse case and a discussion that distinguished it on the basis of privity. There was also an additional discussion in the Sunny Slope case that said, look, in La Crosse, the court at that time was relying upon what was then good precedent from three different jurisdictions, Michigan, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. In the 13 years since the La Crosse decision, there have been decisions from each of those three jurisdictions that have pared back or changed where the courts of those states go on the issue. That was in 1989. Again, since 1989, there have been decisions in each of those three jurisdictions that have further eroded the authority that was originally relied upon in the LaCrosse case, such that I believe that the United States Supreme Court in the East River case characterized the position, the LaCrosse position, as a minority view. I think it may at this point be down to just about that decision only as accepting the proposition. Another point I'd like to make is how the LaCrosse decision fits into what was going on historically at the time. I think in this country as a whole, and as in Wisconsin, you had a situation where in the late 1950s through the 1960s and into the 1970s, tort law was really developing, as a particularly products liability law was developing as its own separate set of laws and rules, and that the courts had not quite yet got to the point where they were probing the outer limits of how far you should go with strict product liability law, but that 10 years later, with the United States Supreme Court's decision in East River, and the many cases that have followed on its heels, including the Sunny Slope decision, courts began defining how far we should go with tort law, and really what should be the purposes and the proper role of tort law as opposed to contract law.
What's the bottom line? Do you think we then have to overrule City of LaCrosse?
No, I don't, because I don't believe that this City of LaCrosse decision was a holding.
Well, one
it
of the
was
things,
dicta.
One of the things you just said, and you said it again, was you talked about dicta. We have some cases basically that indicate that anything we say is not dicta, that it's significant and significant to the overall holding. Why is it dicta in the City of LaCrosse case, the language that Mr. Burnett spotlights in his brief?
Okay. The reason I characterize it as dicta, and let me say, first of all, that's not just my personal characterization. There's been two law review articles. There have been a couple of Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decisions, which, by the way, were cited by this court in Sunny Slope, who also viewed it as dicta. I do believe that whatever this court says is important to all practitioners, regardless of whether it is necessary to the holding in the case. But that in the City of LaCrosse case, where the court found expressly that there was damage to other property other than the product itself, the economic loss doctrine would not apply in any event, because that is the most fundamental exception to the economic loss doctrine.
Why don't you state the economic loss doctrine for me? I think that I understand it, but I think that did. The doctrine shifts periodically when you're talking about it and when in various parts of the brief.
I do believe that the certified question from the Seventh Circuit is a fairly good statement of it. I would make one elaboration. The economic loss doctrine.
Where are you reading from?
Excuse me, I'm reading from page one of Appellee's brief.
Okay.
And I'm looking at the Seventh Circuit's certified question. The economic loss doctrine bars, and of course the question in this case is whether it's a remote commercial purchaser or not, but as a general statement, bars a commercial purchaser from recovery of economic losses from a manufacturer under theories of strict liability and negligence. I would add to that the qualifier that says, in the absence of personal injury or damage to other property, because I believe, as was discussed in Northridge and perhaps touched upon in the argument here today, you can get economic-type damages in a tort claim.
You left out the words in the absence of privity. The economic loss doctrine applies only on a remote commercial producer, because we agree that if it's there's privity, you can get an economic loss if you can prove up the case.
Well, the economic loss doctrine bars tort claims for economic losses. Where there's privity, the buyer may well have a claim in contract or contract-type theories for economic losses, but not in tort. And the question in this case is the next step beyond that. Which is, that was the holding of Sunny Slope. The next step beyond that is, does the same doctrine apply even when the ultimate buyer is remote from the manufacturer?
Well, in my example with Circuit City, as I understand the economic loss doctrine, or I may not, I could not sue Circuit City. Mom and Pop could not sue Circuit City in tort.
Correct. They would be in a situation where they are, relegated to contract remedies, be that express warranty or implied warranty on the commercial code. And I might add that in that circumstance, you run into the same potential problem that we talked about before, which is if this is truly an unsophisticated mom and pop, and if the people at Circuit City put a disclaimer of any warranty in the document and talk about it in the course of the sale, then you have the same circumstance. They are left with no remedy against their direct seller, even though they're unsophisticated parties and they have a product that really doesn't work. They could be in the same position if they bought direct from the manufacturer. That if the manufacturer negotiates a disclaimer and they're unsophisticated and really don't understand it, they're out of luck on their uniform commercial code and contract remedies. And by the way, Sunny Slope says they cannot sue in tort either.
I'm concerned about remedy. And you added to the fact situation here one element. The fact situation, as I understand it, is that the receipt of earrings given to the plaintiff had an express limitation, and it said it expressly limited any warranties implied or stated. Is that your understanding of the facts in this case?
I don't believe it was a receipt. I believe it was the invoice.
The invoice said that.
Yes.
Thank you. In giving your response just now, you added to this mom and pop hypothetical that there was essentially that, and then they discussed it at the time of sale. And you said if they discuss it at the time of sale and they're on the receipt or invoice was an express disclaimer, they are out. The mom and pop can't sue Circuit City, so there's no remedy. You also would say they can't sue Sony. They can't bring a contract action because there is no contract. It's your position they can't bring a tort action because there is no contract. Well, it just doesn't seem to me sound that we should say, Sony, you're manufacturing a blatantly defective product, but you can't bring tort because there's no contract. They can't bring contract because there's no contract. Then everyone go home.
And I think that in part, the perception of unfairness that you're describing is inherent in the economic loss doctrine. Which we're really, that's not what's on trial here, quote unquote, today. That decision has been made and adhered to. There is, if the mom and pop deal directly with the manufacturer and there is a disclaimer of warranties, the disclaimer takes care of the contract uniform commercial code possible claims, and the fact that they are in privity clearly under Sunny Slope would eliminate any potential for a tort claim. And so, I think one can look at this and say, gee, if you have a buyer that is at a sufficient level of being unsophisticated, there may be a harsh result. And yet I believe that the doctrine has been well accepted, certainly in the privity context, by this Supreme Court, and has been well accepted nationally.
Can't we avoid that harsh result? You say well accepted nationally. The reply brief and Justice Crooks point to other jurisdictions who allow an implied warranty action even in the absence of privity. Why shouldn't we do that to avoid this harsh result?
I think that the reason that it should not be done, and let me state first of all that I think that is a minority position nationally, and that there are many other courts who do not recognize an implied right and who, in fact, expressly state the economic loss doctrine bars claims by a remote purchaser, commercial purchaser against the manufacturer, even when the purchaser will have no other remedy, including the New York's highest court. But I think that the problem with it is that It does eventually limit the ability of the parties to freely allocate these risks among themselves. If a manufacturer who has no dealing with someone, you know, once removed, twice removed, three times removed, has a liability, then the manufacturer has to build that into the price of the product. That's what happens in tort cases. Because, in personal injury and damage to other property cases, because that's a policy judgment that has been made that we want that to happen. Because those losses can be so catastrophic and it is so unrealistic to anticipate that the parties will negotiate that. We want that in the tort case. In the case of repair costs and losses of profits, those are things that commercial entities should be deemed capable of negotiating on, and we want that kind of negotiation. If you make the liability to a remote party, you're impinging upon the ability to be able to offer the no warranty at a lower cost from the manufacturer. The manufacturer is going to say, I'm always going to be stuck with that warranty. I have to build it into the price of my product. Let me quickly touch upon just a couple of things, as I know my time at this point is limited. One is the notion that it was Cedar Rapids' responsibility to require or make sure that Ehring conveyed this warranty because Ehring was its agent. The document itself, the distributor's agreement states that Ehring is not an agent, and there is case law suggesting that such an arrangement is not an agency relationship. I don't have a cite to a Wisconsin Supreme Court case, but the Seventh Circuit looked at the issue in the context of Wisconsin law. In Buschendorf versus Freightliner Corporation, 13 Fed 3rd, 1024. So I don't believe that Ehring was, in fact, an agent of Cedar Rapids. I believe my time is up.
May summarize your...
Okay.
Conclusion, and then we'll be done.
Perhaps I will just address my second point, and that was that the attorney for Dana Jansen indicated some confusion or inconsistency in the Seventh Circuit as to how the rule applies. And I would note that the most recent decision, which I supplied to the court after the briefing was closed, because it was done the date that our brief was filed, indicates that the Seventh Circuit firmly believes that this court will rule that the economic loss doctrine applies in the absence of privity, citing, among other cases, the analysis of Judge Evans in the Sikorsky case.
Was it the same panel that certified the question here?
I must confess, I don't know about the identity of the panel.
I mean, if they're so certain about it was Cummings, Easterbrook, and Ripple, why is it certified here? I mean, are they deciding cases at the same time as certifying? Is that what you're telling us?
I would confess to at least some confusion when I saw in the Cooper case, in a footnote, a decision not to certify it to the Wisconsin Supreme Court with no reference to this case.
So they didn't,
I don't know how to...
Well, they didn't catch it. That's what happened their computers or non-computers that they certified the issue and still deciding it. Let's see, in this case, I can't tell from the papers on file who the certification is from. Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We have 5 minutes of rebuttal from Mr. Burnett. Just a minute. Justice Getsky?
Yep.
Do you have any questions?
No, I'm fine. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. On that last point, it was Judge Robner that certified the question.
Pardon?
It was Judge Robner that certified the question.
And the other two members of the panel were?
I think it was certified by a single judge, but I could stand corrected on that.
Okay, thank you.
I would like to just take this brief opportunity to address three issues that were raised by the court. The first is Justice Crook's question about what effect this argument has on this court's decision in City of La Crosse. And aside from all debate as to whether or not the statement in City of La Crosse that, quote, we are also of the opinion that a strict liability claim for pure economic loss involving only the cost of repair or replacement of the product itself and lost profits is likewise not demurrable in Wisconsin. Whether that statement is dicta or not, it became important when this court embraced it and talked about it in the Sunny Slope case. And this court said two things in Sunny Slope. First of all, it said that statement is not clear indication of what we think the law in the state of Wisconsin should be, and to the extent that it allows a tort remedy in Sunny Slope, we disapprove of it. But the court also said that that statement remains a solid statement of Wisconsin law in the circumstance where there is no privity between the parties. So the point is very short and simple, and that is that this court's interpretation of La Crosse in Sunny Slope is neither dicta, and it effectively addresses the question answered by this court. And in my recollection of all of the Seventh Circuit cases, that issue has not been discussed. The second point is this. The ultimate policy question before this court is, what is there to commend itself to? What is about it?